Accession number 16782, Real 2.
Command engage Real 2.
And we would integrate my aircraft into the existing squadron on board Invincible for maintenance purposes. And effectively, although I wouldn't actually be a commanding officer of that squadron, effectively there were two Sea Harrier commanding officers on board the ship at that stage. Now this was about 2 days before the landings took place in San Carlos. So it was we had fairly short time in order to sort of get my pilots acclimatized to what was going on and to integrate ourselves into the tactically speaking into the flying operations. This was not a problem. I mean, it was we were on familiar territory. All of us knew each other very well. We'd all been flying, albeit in different squadrons, during the past couple of years or so. So this was really quite an easy process. And a couple of days later, as I say, the landings took place, and that's really when the really fast and furious action took place. The purpose of the Sea Harrier at this stage was to provide air defense. Now, going back to the original purpose of the Sea Harrier in the Royal Navy, the Sea Harrier was bought and introduced into service as a fighter aircraft primarily. It had a secondary role of reconnaissance, and it had a tertiary role of strike or attack. And we, at that stage, had virtually decided in the Royal Navy that the likelihood of actually doing any attack missions, that is, dropping conventional weapons on ground targets, the likelihood of ever being required to do that was so small that we would not really continue with that as a role. There were various reasons for this, one of which was that at that stage we felt that keeping people worked up in a number of different roles was actually quite difficult. But perhaps more importantly, the likelihood of losing aircraft in a ground attack mission, firing guns or dropping conventional bombs, over modern battlefields with all these sophisticated surface-to-air missile systems that people had at that stage, the likelihood of losing aircraft was really thought to be quite high. And so, although traditionally the Royal Navy had carried out support of ground forces and supporting the army in the field, we had really decided at that stage that this probably wouldn't ever happen in reality in the future, and we would concentrate on the fighter task. So our expectations at that stage were to that we would be involved in purely air-to-air combat missions. In the event, of course, the Sea Harriers carried out a very large number of surface attack missions, I think this is a measure of the flexibility of the aircraft to a great extent, and probably to also to a great extent the flexibility of the people that were flying them, that actually the attack missions were carried out quite successfully. I mean, there were several hundred attack missions carried out, dropping ordnance of various sorts, as opposed to something like 1,200 or so air-to-air combat missions during the Falklands. So about one-sixth, if my recollection is right, of the missions were attack missions, which I think would have surprised those who had been planning it beforehand. The pattern of operations from a flying point of view were that we were essentially trying to defend the amphibious operations area, the area in Falklands where the landings were taking place. in San Carlos. We were trying to provide air defense of that area from a distance. Now, this was a different concept to what we had been working up with from when we had started with the Sea Harrier. The Sea Harrier, as I've said, was really procured as an air defense aircraft to provide air defense of the fleet. And so the concept of operations at that stage was that the Sea Harrier would take off from an aircraft carrier and then essentially be available either from an alert or from combat air patrol cap stations adjacent to where the fleet was to provide air defense of that group of ships. The concept really had not, I think, at that stage been extended to provide air defense of an area at a distance, a remote area. So this idea of flying a distance and then setting up air patrol of that area and then coming back to where you'd started was new. The other point was that we were providing this really at quite a considerable distance, and I think the most we transited was something like 240 miles from where the carrier was to the landing area at San Carlos, and then flew our combat air patrol mission, and then flew that 240 miles back. Now that's quite a considerable transit time. I remember explaining this when I was subsequently talking to Americans after the event, and a lot of people had at that stage the idea that the Harrier was really only capable of taking one bomb, 50 or maybe 80 miles, dropping it and then coming back to base. This idea that the Harrier could actually go a couple of hundred miles, carry out an air patrol mission and then come back was inconceivable to a lot of people. They had no idea that the aircraft was capable of that. And as I say, from my point of view, we had not, in training, we hadn't really practiced this sort of mission, although, in a sense, it really probably didn't need that much practice because when you're carrying out a combat air patrol, it doesn't really matter where you're doing it. If it's 200 miles away from base, it just means you've got to break off your action with slightly more fuel so that you can get back. What it did mean, of course, is that without diversion airfields or other ships to divert to, fuel management and appreciation of how much fuel you were going to use was something that people had to learn very, very quickly. In the event, as I say, on the beginning of it, there was a great deal of unknown. People had no idea what the actual business of fighting was going to be about. This is the biggest single thing before action. As I've said before, this element of unknown, and people had the unknown of how the aircraft was going to perform against the enemy aircraft at this stage, and also the unknown about how they themselves would perform. Now we had no doubt in our minds that the aircraft the Argentines had, the Mirage 3s, that was a perfectly respectable fighter. Mirage 3s are used by air forces around the world at that stage. They had a good track record. They had good weapon system, good missiles, and were certainly capable of putting up a good fight against us. We, on the other hand, knew that we had a good system, albeit that the system as a whole was untried in action. The Sidewinder missile we had been used in action, but not actually from a Sea Harrier. And so, as I say, there was an element of uncertainty at this stage. The first day of actual contact with the enemy was therefore very, very important. And in the event, I almost think that that first day was a sort of was absolutely crucial in the extent that it almost set the pattern for all subsequent operations. What actually happened was that a number of enemy aircraft were shot down by Sea Harriers, and no Sea Harriers were shot down by the enemy. And this had a huge effect on the morale and the way that our people were able to operate. It gave us enormous confidence. I think there were probably, although there were a number of missiles fired against Sea Harriers from the Mirage aircraft, the fact that none of them hit or none of them worked was also another factor that gave people confidence in that our tactics were working. If you roll the whole thing forward a number of weeks, the final tally was 27 enemy aircraft shot down and zero Sea Harriers shot down by the enemy. And this was, I think a lot of this stemmed from the day one, when the confidence it gave us, the fact that we weren't being shot out of the sky, or we weren't having too much of a problem in air-to-air combat. A lot of it stemmed from that initial contact. Looked at from the other way around, I think the demoralizing effect on the Argentine Air Force must have been colossal. Looked at in straight numbers, the actual numbers of aircraft that the Argentines had compared with the number that we had was something like 11 times as many. So if you looked at it on that basis, it was a sort of an 11-to-1 advantage that the Argentines had in terms of combat aircraft. So on that basis, they should have had the advantage. And I think it must have been a devastating blow to them that they actually found that they were losing aircraft. Now that pattern, happily, I'm glad to say, continued. And there were it continued not only in the air-to-air side, but it also continued in the in their ground attack side, or the surface attack, in their attacks against ships. I think there was also another reason why the air-to-air side was successful, and that is that for reasons, various reasons, and mistaken reasons, I think, on the Argentines' part, they decided they would retain a number of aircraft in defense of their airfields ashore. In retrospect, had they actually committed more aircraft to trying to deal with the combat air patrol over the landing area, then perhaps it would have been different. We would have found it difficult to deal with a large number of fighters against us at any one time. In the event, the penny packets that did arrive were actually not too difficult. But really that leads me on to the next stage in the things, and that was the effectiveness of the Argentine surface attack missions, because they were attacking ships with iron bombs, with conventional high explosive bombs. And I think in a lot of their attack missions, they were breaking new ground themselves. They were doing things they had not trained for. Certainly the impression I had at the time was they were doing something that they were probably not properly aware of what was required. I think in simplistic terms, the effectiveness of the Royal Naval ships in firing weapons various at incoming aircraft was such that it was forcing the pilots to fly lower and lower. And the natural reaction, I think, of an attack pilot is, if he's making an attack mission and he sees things being fired at him, or knows that there are things being fired at him, is to get down as low as possible over the water as he can. There's also a natural inclination of people when they're attacking something to try and fly as close to the target as they can to drop a bomb, because it's more accurate if you drop the bomb from the closer you get, the more accurate it is. From the point of view, however, of getting weapons to actually explode, it's quite hopeless dropping them from too low. In retrospect, I think what was happening was that they were dropping far too low in many cases, and the weapons weren't fusing. And all conventional weapons needed a certain time of flight in order for the weapons to actually fuse. And there were a number of cases of unexploded bombs arriving in ships. Now, had the pilots been flying higher, then those weapons, I think, would have fused. On the other hand, they might well have been shot down before they got there, so that's a difficult question. But again, this comes back to training, and there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that the single most important thing in any aerial combat, in any conflict, is the level of training that you can put into this beforehand. In wartime, people generally perform less well than they do in peacetime, because there is the twitch factor, there's the fear factor, there's whatever you want to call it. People are under a deal of stress, and although some degree of stress will make people perform better, generally people perform less well, in my experience, or as well, but no better than they would have performed in peacetime. And so this is terribly important in planning and training and prior to any conflict. The Argentines, I think, lacked, it seemed to me, they lacked experience of attacking ships. And they probably lacked experience in air combat. Looked at the other way round, I had, in the course of the 2 years since I had introduced the Sea Harrier into frontline service, I had managed to arrange practice air combat exercises with most other Western world aircraft. We'd been over to the United States. We had fought in practice missions against most of the current, then current American fighter aircraft types, smart aircraft, modern aircraft, F-14s, F-18s, those sorts of things. We had operated against French aircraft. We had operated around the NATO scene. So we knew what we could do. We knew what our limitations were. We knew what our strengths were, and we had a deal of confidence in what we thought the Sea Harrier could do, and we also knew the capabilities of other aircraft very well. Looked at from an Argentine point of view, we all knew, I think, that opportunities that they must have had to practice their tactics against these same sorts of smart aircraft must have been limited. And I think this was borne out in practice. I think this was a huge limitation for them, and it was a great strength for us. And therein, of course, lies a big message in planning, is that you must practice in peace what you want to do in war. And in war, they were fighting a type of aircraft they probably didn't know too much about. It must have been a huge unknown. They certainly hadn't had the opportunity of flying against Sea Harriers. And so that must have been a great deal of trepidation on their part, I think, in that element of unknown. And also, I don't think they had practiced their attacks against ships, and I think this was borne out by the actual success in the weapon fusing. Now, rolling this forward, of course, operations then continued, and one of the biggest problems was the weather. The weather forecasting in the South Atlantic was quite difficult. In the course of the next year or so after that, I spent a while both ashore in the Falklands and in other ships down there. And there was an expression actually at those stage which said that if you don't like the weather forecast, wait 20 minutes. Now, that's that's an expression you will hear in different parts of the world by people. But the implication of that was, of course, that the rate of change of weather was very high. And with the storm sweeping around Cape Horn, the capability to actually forecast that far ahead of what was going to happen was limited. It would be much better now, it would be much more sophisticated now, but at the time it was difficult to plan ahead from a weather point of view. And of course the other problem was that with very cold water and high humidity, the incidence of fog down there was really quite high. And this played really quite a major part in our flying operations. A lot of the time the Argentines were launching aircraft in lovely, warm, hot weather, stable conditions from the mainland, and arriving in the Falklands 300 miles to the east, and finding they were in a totally different weather pattern. That must have been a problem for them, of course, as well as for us. We, on the other hand, were launching from a position out at sea, a couple of hundred miles or so east of the Falklands, and flying west into the Falklands, into San Carlos, to provide our combat air patrol missions. Our problem was, in addition to dealing with the fog, was dealing with quite high winds and quite high sea states at times. I have very little doubt in my mind that had we had conventional large carriers down there, we would have found it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to operate aircraft at times, simply because of the amount of deck movement, deck pitch in particular. The enormous advantage of the Sea Harrier, with its ability to launch up a ski jump and land vertically, was that really deck pitch was not a practical limitation to us, although there were theoretical limitations on how much movement the ship you could operate with. In practice, there were ways around this. I mean, in simplistic terms, you could actually line the aircraft up on deck, wait for the ship to stop pitching, or for the pitching to die down, and launch in that period. And generally speaking, you can judge it, the pilot can judge it, when to take off, and you can get it right. Similarly, when you're coming into land, you can hover over the ship and wait for the ship to stop pitching wildly before you actually land on. And the ability to do this, of course, is unique to the to a vertical landing aircraft. At that stage, in fighter terms, it's quite unique to the Sea Harrier and to the RAF Harrier. Now, that gave us a colossal advantage, which, had we had a conventional, had we had the old Ark Royal, as people used to say to me, with Phantoms and Buccaneers on board, we would have had in many ways a very capable aircraft in terms of providing air defense with the Phantom and attack missions with the Buccaneer. And we would have had an airborne early warning aircraft in the form of the Gannet. But I genuinely believe that we would have had problems operating a lot of the time. And in that case, we would have been unable to provide combat air patrols over the San Carlos landing area, when with the Sea Harrier we could provide those patrols. Perhaps the best would have been a combination of a large conventional carrier and the smaller one with the Sea Harriers, but I mean that's that of course wasn't ever going to happen. So that really, that ability to operate in bad weather was very important to us, and it did work extraordinarily well, and we were able to operate both by day and by night, and recover aircraft in really down to zero visibility. I mean, there's one particular case where the fog was so thick during a night landing that one of the pilots was really unable to see the ship until he was almost overhead the ship. And there were all sorts of means being used to try and guide him in, including throwing flares over the side of the ship to try and highlight where the ship was and the ship's wake and so on. I don't think we would have recovered any other type of aircraft on board at that stage.
Can you take me through step by step specifically what happened to you from that first crucial day you described in which the first Sea Harrier success was established?
Yes, the general pattern of operations was were essentially daytime operations. We had actually, for quite good reasons, set the clocks in the ships to British Standard Time, to Zulu time, Greenwich Mean Time. This meant in practice that we could operate a normal ship routine, essentially getting up at sort of 7 o'clock, having breakfast, then going to the sort of first operations brief of the day at about 8:30, and from that going into the first flying brief, launching the first aircraft at about 9:30, transiting for the 45 minutes or so, this 200 miles or so into the amphibious operations area, San Carlos, and then spending however long it was, half an hour or 40 minutes or so on combat air patrol before coming back that couple of hundred miles to the ship. Now, the launch at 9:30 was timed so that the first aircraft would arrive in the San Carlos area as dawn was breaking. In other words, the dawn was roughly 10 o'clock in the morning, our time. We then have fast and furious flying operations during the day until the sun set at around 7 or 8 in the evening. And the last aircraft for the daytime serials would launch to have them on combat air patrol around dusk, and then they'd have a night landing. Through the night, we conducted some operations, but inevitably they were reduced from the daytime ones. Now, the normality of this sort of operation was, I think, again, quite an important part in operations. The more normal you can keep things in wartime to your practice in peacetime, as I've commented on earlier, the better. And so what this meant to us was that, generally speaking, people were leading a normal sort of day, normal daytime flying operations with the added nighttime ones. Had we kept local time, of course, we would have been doing everything in essentially in the middle of the night. We'd have been getting up in the middle of the night and so on. So this was that was one factor. Now, a normal day's operation, and I think the sort of early days for me of these operations were flying two or maybe three times a day, normally pairs of aircraft, to take off from the ship, as I've said, sometimes in really quite bare pitching deck, poor visibility conditions, sometimes most glorious sunshine weather and almost flat calm. General pattern was to fly at low level, to avoid any sort of radar coverage, being able to pinpoint where the carriers were, flying at low level for a while and then climbing up to high level for the remainder of the transit. Transiting at high level, 30,000 or above, 1,000 feet into the San Carlos area, then letting down to whatever height we thought was going to be best for the combat air patrol. Keeping outside of the immediate landing area where the air defense was being provided by the ships, waiting to see whether any Argentine aircraft appeared, and then doing what we could to either shoot them down or to stop them coming in. I have some very vivid recollections of this sort of this period. I mean, one